Okay, so we're here talking about Windows Server 2008. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Alex Henricks. I'm the project manager for Windows Server 2008.
All right, awesome. So first question, we'll get it out of the way. When is Windows Server 2008 going to ship?
So by the time you see this video, Server 2008 will have RTM'd.
Awesome, awesome. So let's talk about Windows Server 2008 and some of the dev process that goes into it. So just for people to understand the scale, how big are we talking from a team perspective?
So in terms of the number of people, we have about 1,000 people who work on this day in and day out as their full-time job. But at some point or another during the development cycle, this is touched by 10,000 people at Microsoft.
Wow.
And some are in Redmond, some are in Ireland, some are in India, some are in China. I mean, it's a worldwide process.
And that includes localization teams, testing teams.
That's right.
Dependency teams, core technology teams, everything in between.
That's right.
And as well as, I guess, some of the server products that use it just to make sure things work together.
If I included all the testing that the server application teams do and the other teams within Microsoft do, then that number doubles pretty quickly.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, awesome. So we know Windows Server 2008 from some of the features that you guys have done, and I think it was the last Windows Server 2003 that was retired from MSCOM. You guys have been doing a ton of, I'd call it dog fooding.
That's right.
So why don't you talk a little bit about how Microsoft does dog fooding and then some of your early adopter programs as
okay.
well.
So us and a lot of other companies refer to eating your own dog food.
Okay.
Which means that if you're a software company, you're producing software for everyone in the world to run. Well, during the development process, you better be running that software yourself, right?
Right.
Both on your desktop and as part of the IT infrastructure.
Right.
And so, dog fooding is deep. In our culture here, and so as you can imagine, early in the development cycle, right? There are some pains and moans and groans as you work out the bugs in the system.
Yeah, absolutely.
But as you fix those bugs and the software becomes more mature, right? It really gives us by dogfood. It really gives us confidence that we've shipped something that we can look for Ford Motor Company, U.S. Army, or someone like that, right in the eye and say, you can bank on us. Now, the way we do that is we work in close partnership with both MSIT, which is our own internal IT folks, and there's a whole team
right.
within MSIT who's responsible for working with the development team to roll out Windows Server throughout the milestones. And we test within MSIT every single role in Windows Server. So you can imagine we have file servers all over the company.
Mm-hmm.
We have Active Directory all over the company. We have web servers all over the company, and
right.
all the way down the line. Many of these are clustered. I mean, we're testing every possible permutation.
And like Active Directory, we're talking like all the primary domain controllers worldwide. So like.
Well, so not every domain controller worldwide runs it because we need to have 2003 and 2000 domain controllers up to make sure that our heterogeneous environment works because that's what customers have. And then also when we apply service packs, we need service packs on those machines. So, but to give you some examples, the domain that the Windows Server development team uses, we put the first Win 2008 DC up in the end of 2005.
Oh, really?
Yes. So,
okay.
So a little over 2 years ago, and then all of the NT development domain went up to Windows 2008 DCs in May of 2006.
Okay. Wow.
So for 18 months. A little more than 18 months. We've been eating our own dog food, and since it wouldn't be when people working on Windows coming on Monday morning, and you got this flood of authentications.
Right.
It's been against 2008 code.
Wow, that's awesome. So, have there been any scalability improvements or performance improvements that you can talk about, or maybe not just necessarily Active Directory, but in general? Scott Guthrie had talked about some of the hosting improvements for IS7, but just in general.
The the main things we find are reliability improvements, right?
Okay.
We trip over any reliability bugs before our customers do.
Mm-hmm.
And because you could imagine that in the morning if some log guns start failing, those phones burn up pretty quick, and
right.
then the AD devs are in there on the debugger and fixing that problem immediately, fixing that bug, getting it checked in, getting those machines patched.
Right.
And when that happens throughout the cycle, you end up with a pretty robust DC.
Wow.
So with Active Directory, we do a ton of dog fooding. Another area where we've invested a lot in dog fooding is with IIS.
Okay. Right.
And I'm probably repeating some of the stuff that Bill Staples has told you, but it's worth repeating. That Microsoft.com, which mm-hmm. is one of the five most active sites in the world, you know the numbers better than me,
huge.
That's been running on IIS7 for a year.
Right.
Right. And by doing that over the course of a year, I mean, that gives us quite a bit of confidence that SHIP 2008 with IIS7, that IIS7 is just absolutely rock solid.
Right.
So,
right.
On top of the dog fooding that Microsoft.com does, there are a number of internal websites that are running IIS7 that are some are managed by our IT infrastructure, and others are just roll your own servers that teams bring up to help them. You know, they need a website for whatever reason, and they do that running IIS7.
Sure. So, and what about some of the external customers that you've seen dog fooding in different scenarios?
So. So I'll keep going on the IIS7 path.
Sure.
There's what's called the IIS7 Go Live program,
mm-hmm.
and there's over 2,000 customers that are running production websites on IIS7 using the Go Live program.
Awesome.
And that's been going on for over a year,
mm-hmm.
and so you get that external validation because they find things that we never think of or would never find because of their environment or the creative ways they think of using IIS.
Sure.
And so that's been really productive for the IIS team, as well. Externally, we have over 1,000 servers in production, independent of IIS. We have over 1,000 servers in production on various server roles
at a
number of Fortune 500 companies and universities and governments, and all the way down to some small companies. And the roles that we get the most testing on are Active Directory file servers TS terminal server and NAP servers.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So we talked about some of the actual customers going in. So let's say I'm one of those Fortune 500 customers, like in the dev process, they report a bug. It's
right.
It's now reproducible,
yes.
if you will, or somebody's able to find the exact situation where
yes.
it's reproducible. How do they give you that feedback, and how does it sort of trickle down into the dev teams, like, and then eventually going into ship room, and you can talk about kind of what ship room is, and then the validation that it's fixed, and some of the process that you take. You know, this is the most reliable. It sounds like from what I hear you saying, the most reliable Windows server we've ever shipped. So what are the processes that you guys did to make it that way?
Hey. So, if I go through the life cycle of a customer bug here,
right?
Let's say we have AD installed at a customer site, and boom, they have a bug that pops.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a team of folks whose job it is to own that relationship with that external customer. It's called the Technical Adoption Program, or TAP.
Right,
so
right.
those TAP customers, we have a team that works with those TAP customers. And those TAP customers have all the cell phone numbers and home numbers of the folks at Microsoft that run that TAP program. And they immediately call our folks.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks who run the TAP program here, they have contacts with each and every component and role team within the operating system,
mm-hmm.
right? And so let's say it's an Active Directory bug that they find.
Sure.
They immediately are able to call someone on the Active Directory team,
mm-hmm.
and that person on the AD team, in most cases, can remote in, because we'll have debuggers attached to those machines.
Oh,
they
really?
Can, yes.
Okay.
So they can remote in and try to debug the situation remotely. In rare cases where Or they can't remote in, we'll put people on airplanes and fly them out to the customer site to get things fixed up.
Okay.
And so then if it's a customer's blocked or a customer down situation, they'll actually spin a private fix, you know, pronto and get the customer back up. Mm-hmm. And then it's really, thank you, customer. You've given us a great bug. Now the AD team will take this bug and bring it into their team's process, which is for the Active Directory team, they're looking at we have a database of all the bugs across the entire operating system, and those bugs are broken into a hierarchical component tree. Mm-hmm. According to the operating system. So, you know, you go on the hierarchy and boom, there's a set of AD bugs.
Okay.
Every single day, the AD team is triaging that list of bugs.
Right.
Right. And the ones that are found through the TAP program, those bounce to the top of the list. Right.
Right. Right.
A real customer in deployments found this. If they found it, there'll probably be a 1,000, 10,000 other customers that are going to find it over the lifetime of Server 2008.
Sure.
So the AD team will look at that. Will look at that bug. In many cases, they already have the fix because they provided the private to the customer.
Right. Right.
But in other cases, it might require a little bit deeper change. And mm-hmm. so the dev lead for that piece of Active Directory and the test lead and the program manager will get together, formulate a fix, mm-hmm. and then they'll work within their AD team and say, we need to fix this at this time. And then there's a whole – then, as I mentioned, there's 10,000 people that work on Windows.
Right.
So there's a whole multi-layered process before it actually gets to main ship room, which is what I run.
Right.
So the Active Directory team will have their ship room and say, this is important. We need to fix this. We have the fix. It's been tested. We're ready to check this into the OS.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a ship room that has all the server components. So it's teams like Active Directory, Terminal Server, IIS, all the way down the line.
Sure.
And there's someone on my team who runs that ship room. Mm-hmm. And the AD team will tell the project manager on my team, this is the problem we have. It was seen by such and such a customer. We've got to fix it. Okay, I understand. I understand the scenario. I understand the code fix. Let's bring it up. And then in the main ship room, which I run,
right.
There's all this middle tier of branches, which we call VBLs. I can explain those later.
Okay.
All these middle, all these mid-level ship rooms, they come to me and they describe the issues and the problems and the code fixes that they want to bring into the OS.
Mm-hmm.
And so on this AD bug, they'll either the project manager on my team or someone from the AD team will say, Alex, we saw this bug in this scenario. We had this crash, right? We've got the fix ready. We need to bring it in, and I'll ask them a couple of questions about it. And if we're all in agreement, then boom, they get approval to check it in,
mm-hmm.
and in it goes.
Okay.
So it sounds like a long-winded, drawn-out process, but
how long is it from the customer called Arcel at 3 in the morning to, you know, it's approved in the official ship room and in the product?
Right. It all depends upon where we are and the development cycle.
Okay.
If it is, say, well, if we roll the clock all the way back in time, if it's 2000, you know, if it's 2006, all right, it might take a couple of weeks for it actually to flow through the whole system because in 2006 and early 2007 there's actually a lot of code coming up into the system because we had new features, a lot of mm-hmm. bug fixes,
a lot of everything's in flux.
That's right. There's a lot of code churn during that period because that's when we're innovating and doing a lot of development. And so before that code move, these big chunks of code move up, you want to work a little bit more slowly, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to do a lot of additional testing before bringing big chunks of code into the OS because you don't want to destabilize it.
Sure.
But then as you get deeper into the development cycle and get close to a release candidate, right? A customer bug like that, like I just described, if there's a server down, I mean, we'll get that into the build within 2 days.
Okay. Awesome.
Right? So things happen much more quickly because the issues are more urgent. We want to get into the builds and start testing start getting our giant Windows test machine rolling on these changes.
It's sort of considered done, if you will, and you'll take fixes, but there isn't, like, say, net new development coming at that late part in the cycle. Like, somebody isn't just adding a random feature. It's everything's about stability, stability, stability.
That's right. We locked down our feature list for Windows Server at the beginning of 2007.
Okay.
Right? So a year in advance, we say, we're done with our features.
Right.
This is it. All we do now is test, and fix key bugs that our internal test teams find,
mm-hmm.
and then key bugs that we find in external deployments, and, of course, the dog food bugs that we'd see.
Yeah, I think a lot of customers will be sort of impressed that we that rigorous, if you will, that we're not adding features after 2007. It really is just everything towards reliability and stability.
You have to do it that way. And, I mean, you can imagine that we have a lot of smart people with a lot of great ideas, and everyone wants, you know, it's natural to want to add something to server. I mean, it's just a natural instinct. If you have creative people, they want to add things and try to make things better. But really, once you lock your feature list down, I mean, it just takes a lot of discipline to say, no, no, no. All we're doing is we're just going to improve upon the reliability of the product.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to add new bells and whistles. And that's consistent with what our customers tell us,
mm-hmm.
right? They tell us if they're asked to weigh new shiny toys or make this as solid and secure as you can, they're always in the solid, secure camp.
Right.
And so by locking your feature down a year in advance, right, we can meet
and you're
that
listening
promise
to customers, yeah.
So
the last part, just to close up the bug scenario, what are the things that teams do to validate bugs? So the things checked in, how do you make sure it is in fact fixing it, hasn't introduced other bugs, or what are some of the things that you go about, even when there's a bug fix, it could either break something else or validate those? Are there automation or anything within there?
That's a great question. I mean, and we have lots of different techniques for validating those fixes. First, there's the obvious one, right? The test team that I'm not beating up on the Active Directory team. I'm just using an example. If we use that Active Directory bug, the test lead for that area will make sure that they add test cases and add automation to cover that and exercise that code path over and over and over again. So that's
mm-hmm.
a very local thing that the Active Directory team can do. In addition, these teams, they understand who is dependent upon their code, right? And so, and they have, it's almost like a beehive, right? They have relationships all over the system and say, you know what, with this change in AD, it might affect this piece and this piece and this piece. And they let the test managers in those groups know, you might want to add test cases to cover this because we just made a change in AD.
Right.
So that's another piece that happens. What we'll also do is if we think that it could impact MSIT or other TAP customers, We'll take that private fix and we'll drop it on our internal dog food servers,
mm-hmm.
and we'll hand it to various TAP customers because
mm-hmm.
that gives us additional production testing on that specific fix that gets made.
Right.
In addition, when we write all the automation, we have tools that measure the level of automation for that specific piece of code, and these tools can look at the automations and say, you know what? The automation that you wrote covers 72.8% of the possible code paths that the customer is gonna run through,
mm-hmm.
and so the test will go off and create more automation and get that as close to 100% as they can.
Sure.
So we also have tools that allow us to see all the dependencies between any code change. It's actually pretty slick that a developer can make a change in one module,
mm-hmm.
right? And in what gets some a very simple piece of data that comes back, it says, you know, how many blocks of code change,
mm-hmm.
and with our existing automation, what percent of that code is getting tested with our current automation?
Mm-hmm.
But then this is where it gets fun. It says we're also able to tell for what binaries in the system are dependent upon the binary that changed.
Awesome.
Okay, so obviously, if you make a change deep in the stack, like it, like TCP/IP, right? Right. There's tons of dependencies.
Yeah.
Right? But if you make a change to something very high in the stack, like a wizard in Server Manager, mm-hmm. right? There's very few dependencies, and so those are built up automatically. So we know all the entire dependency list. But even better is that we know for that exact code change that we're making, uh-huh. right? We can say within those dependent binaries what the specific part of that dependent binary is affected. So even though it might be a large binary that's impacted by this small code change,
right.
maybe only one code path in that binary hits this change code path. And so that test team can just do some very focused testing there, and we know exactly what our risk is on that change, whether it's high risk or low risk.
Right, right. And that may make your decision on whether to actually approve or not approve.
Absolutely. Because as you can imagine, when early, you know, a year, when you're a year away from shipping, you know, you don't do that kind of deep analysis on every single bug that's coming through the system.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get in the last 90 days, when you want to take zero risk and want to make sure you don't regress or make anything worse by trying to make things better,
sure.
You want to do the analysis you just mentioned and assess that risk on every single fix, because you might think that the impact of the system's small, because I'm just making every dev has heard this, a one-line change. I'm just making a one-line change, and that one-line change can explode throughout the system,
right?
Or when using the using these code analysis tools, no, that one line change really, really only affects a very thin stream, and our risk is low.
Right. So you mentioned that dependency tool. Is that an internal Microsoft only? Is that Windows or team only?
I think it's a Microsoft only tool, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
No.
All right. So some cool stuff. So speaking of Shiproom, you know, as things get sort of closer to ship, sometimes
right.
People resort to blatant bribery to get their bugs checked in, and we think this is good. I know I personally have brought, I don't know, 20 cupcakes one time to make sure that Shiproom felt warm and fuzzy about taking a bug. So tell us kind of what's the funniest thing somebody's done to get their bug approved or their bribery, if you will.
So that's a hard question. So the I will say that for the last 6 months, bribery just flat out doesn't work.
Right,
it really doesn't.
Right,
and it doesn't for a number of reasons. One that I'm tough to bribe, and two, you know, we really, because there's so many people involved, and I mentioned we have these multiple layers of ship rooms and triage.
Right.
From my chair, when I'm running this main ship room, I got to be very transparent. Mm-hmm. Right. The decision making has to be very, very clear, and I've got to be very, very consistent. Because if I'm inconsistent, I don't have any credibility, and things fall apart. So. So you can imagine that any form of favor just doesn't work, because if I give so-and-so a favor, then I will definitely be called out by – if I give Fred a favor, then Sue is going to call out and go, whoa, 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 you're being inconsistent. What
are you doing? Right.
So – but I can say that, you know, a year and a half ago we were going through what features are we going to add
and
you know, should we change this or not? Myself and my boss and my boss's boss are in a meeting with one of the GPMs,
mm-hmm.
and he had gotten his wife to make banana cake, right? But not like some little cheesy banana cake, like bona fide hardcore banana cake. And he's got all this banana cake laid out. He got everyone a nice pen.
Oh yeah.
And he's like, I got you a banana cake and pen just 'cause you can just click yes, right?
Oh, that's great.
So we thought that was
that's a good one.
We thought that was pretty funny. And now we did say yes on what he wanted to do, but we were gonna say yes anyway.
Sure, sure. It makes everybody, I guess, feel yeah. better about the change, if nothing else. How about your favorite features of Windows Server 2008?
So the my favorite feature has been from the start is Server Core.
Okay.
Right? And what Server Core is, it's a smaller, lighter weight, small footprint version of Server. So when you do a normal install of server, right, you get the full GUI and on all the or a percentage of the system files are laid down, and the services are laid down, and but with Server Core, it's a GUI-less, small, tight version of the OS with a just a handful of key roles, like we web server, file server, Active Directory, DNS, DHCP, and print, and there's a couple other which I can't remember off the top of my head.
Sure, sure.
But we're fired up about it, and the customers that are in the know and understand this, they are very, very excited about this because it means that there are fewer binaries laid down.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to worry about any shell, GUI, IE type of stuff. And
iTunes on the server needing to be updated, you know, not necessarily.
Not important.
Yeah.
Not
bad admins, yeah.
But it also allows for future servicing, right? There's far fewer patches that have to go down on Server Core because there's fewer components.
Sure.
And we think this is an important way for us. It's the first time we've done this in server, and I think, you know, moving forward, it's going to be a really, really important way to install server.
Okay, so how small is Server Core?
So Server Core is if I'm remembering my numbers right, it's about a quarter of the size of a regular server install.
Okay, awesome.
Right? So 25%.
Okay, and I guess management is done.
Most management is done remotely.
Okay. Right? So is it
now you can
remote
sit there.
Desktoping, or is it that I'm sending commands, or walk me through how somebody would set up, you know, their server farm,
right,
or server core.
So so you can manage it locally, right? If you're sitting right there at the box, mm-hmm, and you have command line tools, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so so you can use all your standard command line tools, and you can use WMI, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And
PowerShell by chance?
For PowerShell, I believe that you have to have the CLR, which is the CLR is not on Server Core.
Okay.
So, but for remote admin, which is what the majority of administrators are going to do,
mm-hmm,
they are able to terminal server into the box,
mm-hmm,
and they can also, you know, use WMI remotely.
Okay.
Right. And for a huge percentage of our admins, right, they're used to doing things this way. They're used to using command line and scripting things, and this is just a natural extension of what they do with full blown server,
mm-hmm,
and they can do much of those same things with Server Core.
Awesome. And how about some of the things for other server products and support for them? So we know we have Exchange, we have SQL Server 2008, we have a number,
right,
of server products, and I know you had mentioned some of the dog fooding scenarios, but what's the story with support for other server products?
Okay, so for both Exchange and SQL, right, are the customers, they expect, you know, when you ship a new version of server, well, Exchange works as advertised and SQL works as advertised.
Mm-hmm.
And so so we've been partnered with the Exchange and SQL teams during the entire development process of Server 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the Exchange side, right, you can take Exchange 12 and plus Service Pack 1, which,
mm-hmm,
is Service Pack 1 is a requirement. And and that's been tested and validated on Server 2008. In fact, the Exchange team has sign-off privileges to Server 2008, which they've done. And, of course,
walk through what that means for somebody that's not familiar with sign-off privileges.
Sure. So what we do is, I mean, since there's 10,000 people involved, you know, in the development of Windows Server, you want everyone to nod their head and say, we are ready to ship this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so from test managers to development managers to group program managers to general managers, vice presidents, et cetera, all these folks, we want them to actually sign on the dotted line and say, we are ready to ship this. And,
mm-hmm,
we have over 1,000 people that sign off on the product. And Exchange,
wow,
the Exchange team has a set of those 1,000 people. The SQL team has a set of those 1,000 people. And so what we've been doing with those teams is, like I said, we've been in partnership for the past couple of years, and not only do their teams run test cases, right, their own internal test suite of of Exchange running on Server 2008, but like everything else, we dog food it, right? And as of this date, right, these numbers will get bigger over time, but as of this date, we have 35,000 Exchange mailboxes running on Exchange 12 on Server 2008 internally inside Microsoft.
Awesome.
Right? Outside Microsoft, we've got 85,000 mailboxes running. And so, you know, 120,000 mailboxes, we feel pretty confident. Of course, you know, with anything else, there were bumps along the way.
Sure.
And there were plenty of days where we're getting outages on mail. And as most people know, if your mail's down, you're pretty handcuffed, and so those get quite a bit of attention. But we'd rather us experience those mailbox down problems rather than our customers.
Sure.
And so
and so
we invest quite a bit in making sure that Exchange and Windows 2008 work well together. On the SQL side, it's similar. Similar process. The SQL team's been testing for a couple of years, and they'd find a bug. There's a senior program manager on my team who works closely with them, and they say, "Here's a bug we find." And similar to the process I described earlier, he knows the owners of every component in the operating system. He goes and talks to them about this is the bug the SQL's
right.
finding, et cetera, et cetera. It goes to the triage process, and it gets checked in. You do this. You do this a few hundred times, and you end up with SQL being in great shape on Server 2008. And I believe SQL, it requires Service Pack 2.
Okay.
Right?
And I think some of those scenarios, like talking about the different Service Pack requirements, are because sometimes the bug isn't Windows Server. It's
right.
actually their product bug. Maybe they have a dependency, or I've done something
right.
they shouldn't have, if you will, and they need to make a change to their code base as opposed to yours. Is that fair?
It runs both ways. I mean, sometimes it, like you said, it is a bug that that always existed in that application and maybe wasn't exposed in 2003, but suddenly gets exposed in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And in other cases, we've shifted the sand underneath them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they need to respond to that shift in the sand, and it requires a service pack for them to respond. We've done quite a bit of internal testing with SQL, not only the SQL team running their own test cases, but we also have a number of internal line of business apps that are running on SQL on Windows 2008. So that gives us quite a bit of confidence that our customers are going to have a good experience there.
Okay. Great. All right. Well, any other closing remarks or anything?
No. Just we're happy. I mean, for a lot of us, this has been 5 years of our professional lives doing nothing but working on Windows Server, and so for us to hit this day is pretty exciting for us and pretty rewarding. I think it's something that we'll remember forever.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.